So Kokyo is going to continue with our discussion this afternoon, and we're going to continue. One thing I wanted to mention before you start, though, is that this morning I was reminded that when we talked about the kind of evolutionary imperative that we have to know, to come to knowledge, I was thinking how, like you said the first day, how truly intimate this situation is. This is a very delicate affair, this merging of difference in unity. It reminds me of a story I heard from Tenshin Roshi, your teacher, at one time. He told the story of Amor and Psyche, the Greek myth of Amor and Psyche. And it has the same context of darkness and light, the same, what we're looking at, the same element of darkness and light built into the story. So in ages past, the mind, Psyche, was in this story was a beautiful woman, and she was such a beautiful woman that the goddess of beauty, the goddess of love, became jealous of her. You know this? Remember this?
I don't remember all the details.
Tenshin told this to us one time. And the goddess was jealous. The ideal love was jealous of real love, of physical love, or realized love, you could say, and had to destroy it in this story. And she sent her son, Amor, or Eros. There's a picture of him, Cupid. Mm-hmm. He has a bow to shoot the, and I guess, and the way it's come to us, they kind of fall in love when the arrow is. But
it's kind of a love potion on the arrow tip.
Something like that. Yeah. But these arrows are also made to kill. So she sent her son to kill psyche, to kill the mind, to kill knowledge, to kill awareness, because awareness was getting too much attention. Knowledge was coming up, and so Amor or Eros, when he went to kill Psyche, he fell in love with her, and he kept it secret, and they were lovers. They were in conjugal bliss, but he made a rule that they could only be together in the dark, in darkness. And for a while, that was fine.
Was it Psyche who made the rule, or Eros?
It was Eros who made the rule. Because he was a god. Because he couldn't reveal himself as a god, apparently. And so finally, Psyche's sisters said, "You're crazy to not know who your lover is. It could be a monster. It could be, you just don't know. You have to know. You have to come to knowledge. And you can imagine what the personification of this, the mind, the doubt, maybe. One of the mind's sisters is doubt, or maybe reason, something like that. Anyway, so she took a lamp, an oil lamp, and when Eros was sleeping, she lit the lamp and she saw what he was, and he was beautiful. He was perfect. And she saw him. She saw love. Knowledge, or the mind, saw love. But in seeing it, she wounded love. She spilled a little oil and wounded it. And Eros fled. Eros left. That was the end of the relationship. That isn't quite the end of the story. Kind of ties in with practice in a way. Afterwards, she has to do all this practice, all this work, these many tasks to be joined again with Eros, with Cupid. So I thought of that this morning. This, the beginnings of our awareness as rational beings, you could say, begins in this kind of dark place. And here in the Western, here in our Western life, we have, what would you say? We've eaten the apple. We've left the garden because we've eaten, and because we had to know. We had to turn the light on and see what union was, how everything is connected. And in seeing that, this is how the story goes. We harm it. So it occurred to me, this is a very delicate affair that we're doing.
Psyche only got to see him in all that perfection for an instant before he
left.
Left.
Western knowledge, what do they call it? The Western, how they define knowledge is one of the ways is it's called the law of identity. Have you heard that? It basically says that A is equal to A. A thing in itself identifies it. That's sort of our Western way of understanding. A thing implies itself. So A equals A. That's the law of identity. And there's a second law called the law of contradiction. And this is all Western logic. That says A is not non-A. And then there's a third law, which is called the law of the excluded middle. Are there any people that have studied logic? Do you know this? It's the law of the excluded middle says a thing is either A or non-A. It's either one or the other.
It can't be the middle.
But wait, there's one more. And I think this was invented in California, actually. This was later in Western logic. It's the law of connection. And it says that everything that's not A supports and defines what A is. Mm-hmm. That had to be a California add-on. So I think that's a good, an interesting counterpoint to where we are. Could you return us to our text?
Sure. You speak about intimacy again, and I was also thinking we have this intimate entrustment from east to west, this mitsu, intimate. So in thinking about these two sides of practice, I also was thinking this morning of this phrase, men mitsu no kafu. Have people heard that? So this is connected with Soto Zen, and kafu literally means house wind, the wind of the house, but it's a poetic way of saying like the style of a certain school of teaching. So maybe other schools of Zen and Buddhism have different kafus with these different little phrases. But there's a saying that I don't know where it arose, but a saying in Japan that for Soto Zen, that the style of the house is Nemitsu, and mitsu is this intimacy. Yeah, intimate is one connotation of it. And men means cotton. So literally, like, it's like the intimacy of the weave of cotton, like very kind of like very finely woven, like a kind of tight weave. So I think intimate in this case can have different connotations too, like just very fine, minute, subtle.
Integrated.
And we could say, usually that's, I think it's a Japanese way of saying, like very careful attention to things. Maybe Suzuki Roshi spoke of it that way. And maybe it also has this flavor of practice is very finely woven. It's very subtle practice. This issue of Sandokai and how we practice with it is intimately woven, but also seems to have this meaning of very careful attention to detail is the style of Soto Zen, right? That I think Rinzai Zen has a different flavor. I don't know if there's a official kafu for Rinzai Zen, but it's more about, as I understand it, more about strong energy and kind of very vigorous sort of practice. Maybe not as, I think maybe I've heard some stories that some Rinzai teachers and practitioners sometimes tease Soto Zen people a little bit about being too concerned with like details.
Like the form?
Yeah, like form. I think Soto Zen, like in a Japanese monastery, Soto and Rinzai, of course, they're both very formal, complicated kind of practice. But my understanding is that Soto Zen really gets into the the fine distinctions and very kind of elaborate ceremonial functioning around really small things, you know. And I think this is the practice has gotten passed down to us in that way. It manifests in so much of how we do things, right? Just carefully thinking about how the tea service will go, or oryoki meals, we're really trying to remember. And in this sashimi, we're particularly, you know, we're comparing all these details, like, oh, the tenzo comes in at this point. Oh no, but is that before?
Yeah, because we have these two sides that are
That are, and we're in. That's in soto zen. We're into these details.
Yeah.
We're like, it's our part of our style is this menmitsu, and there's intimacy in the details, but the connotation I thought of it in was just about the relative and the ultimate, and about phenomena and principle. So we have this principle that's like formless zazen, like the mind of Buddha that can't be talked about and includes everything. Nothing's careful or uncareful in that mind. Nothing. There's no distinctions like that. And then the other side is in the relative world of practice. It's like this very careful attention to all these minutia of practice. And I think it's interesting that soto zen, I might have expected the style of the house to be put like vast, open expansiveness is the style of the house, but instead it's like the intimate weave of cotton. There's something surprising about that to me. Of course there's both sides.
Actually, it feels very comfortable too, kind of closer to home. You
know? Yeah, it's it's very grounded.
Yeah.
I think that's another difference between just comparing soto and rinzai a little. That rinzai's emphasizing more, as I understand, emphasizing the kensho moment more, breaking through to the ultimate. At all cost, which means like, don't worry so much about the details. Just break through, and if it gets a little rough around the edges, okay. And soto zen is more like, no, just take care of all this little, like rough around the edges. Just like the ultimate will be revealed in the
in the details,
in the details, in the relative. The darkness, the dark source, will be revealed in these light branching streams. Something like that is in our style of practice. So, I think it's easy to get trapped in either side. In the, you know, as we were talking about this morning, like emptiness, sickness. Right, the student of Koban who kind of got stuck in the dark, and then it's easy to get stuck in the other side of just getting so caught up in the details that we forget the source that it's all based on. Interacting brings involvement. At the same time, each keeps its place, its dharma position. Sights vary in quality and form. Sounds differ as pleasing or harsh. I don't think there's so much to say there. This is just talking about the relative world of phenomena, of difference. Different kinds of sights, different kinds of sounds. Now, refined and common speech come together in the dark, this one says. Clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light. Or I think the translation that we have here is, darkness is a word for merging upper and lower. Light is an expression for distinguishing pure and defiled. That's quite different. this one is talking about the phrases and the words being distinguished in the light, and then these other kinds of words in the darkness, they all blend together and there aren't distinctions of language and words and so on. And this one is kind of like defining the terms of darkness and light. I kind of like that straightforward approach. If we're talking about that in the darkness, refined and common speech come together, or are, can't be distinguished, and in the light, clear and murky phrases are distinguished.
In this one, it's in darkness, the fine and mediocre accord. Brightness makes clear and murky distinct.
So that one doesn't even bring up this thing about phrases and words, which I notice is in the Chinese. There's the character for word and phrase. But that's also, I think, a couple others are similar to that in that they don't mention words and phrases. They're just, again, just, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, I have a question. Because in our thinking, in English and in our society, the words clear and murky are somewhat loaded words. Mm-hmm. They're not, you know, the same weight or meaning. So I'm wondering whether the Chinese words are equally loaded, or is one better than the other, or are they just different?
Well, for the first part that has refined in common, actually, is it's a character for like higher and middle instead of lower, but the notes say middle in this case means just lower than high. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of like high-low thing going on there. And I think clear and murky, pure, clear, and impure or muddy. Mm-hmm. So I think it's hard. They're, in both cases, it's about duality. And in the dark, clear and murky are it's in the dark that upper and lower, high and middle, are not, cannot be distinguished. So these dualities can't be distinguished in the dark. Could be just a really basic meaning. And in the light, clear and murky are, you know, pure and muddy are, can be seen in the relative, that is the relative world of distinctions and dualities.
That's similar to this translation. Mm-hmm. It says, in the darkness you can't tell up from down, but in the brightness you can distinguish between pure and defiled.
Yeah. As we've been talking about, right? Yeah. It's just further poetically elaborating. And if we went with this one with, you know, darkness in quotes is a word meaning merging upper and lower, light is an expression that means that, or for distinguishing pure and defiled. So it seems to be like just defining these terms more and more. Dark, the darkness where we can't see any differences, where amor lives in the light, where psyche lives and knows good and bad and murky and clear and all that. Yeah.
Do you think this has something more to do with like ignorance and clear seeing, or more like the teachers, you have more absolute relative, where according to the absolute it doesn't matter whether it's refined or common?
Yeah, I think it's more absolute and relative. And at some point somebody mentioned something like, well, it doesn't seem like we want to be making judgments of good or bad and in terms of light and dark. And I think that's true. Light and dark in this case, meaning like relative and ultimate, is not a matter of good and bad. We might think that the darkness is better where there's no distinctions. But in terms of the two truths, it's not really a matter of better or worse. It's like two truths are always operating at the same time. They're always integrated. We can't have one without the other. As Nagarjuna says, who's really expounded these two truths very clearly, it's a lot of what he was about, is one of the most classic verse on this. He says, without a foundation in the conventional truth, the meaning of the ultimate cannot be known or realized. Without realizing the meaning of the ultimate, liberation or nirvana cannot be attained. Which is a nice couplet there of verses, right?
Could you say that again?
That without a foundation, is one translation, a foundation, or you could even say being grounded in the conventional, with the ultimate cannot be realized. Without a foundation in the conventional truth of interdependent phenomenal world, the ultimate emptiness where there is nothing happening in the dark cannot be realized. So then we think, oh, well, this is so important, the conventional, right? That's a kind of plug for the conventional. But without realizing the ultimate, liberation cannot be achieved. So that's a plug for the ultimate. We need both. And again, this Nenmitsu no Kafu, right? Without being grounded in taking care of the conventional world of our life, and in Sesshin, that's, you know, just all the details of practice. It becomes very simple in one sense, and it becomes very complicated in another sense compared to our ordinary life, the relative world. But the foundation is just taking care of all that stuff, just following the schedule, just continuing, keeping the posture as, you know, the relative world. And then with that foundation, then the ultimate is always right there. It's right there from the beginning. But if we say, oh, well, that stuff doesn't matter, then we might miss the ultimate that's right there with it. So, particularly though, if we're talking now about the words and phrases connected with black and white and relative and ultimate, another koan comes up here called Matsu's Black and White. Do you know this one? This is another kind of like longer involved story. And people, you know, people interpret these things in different ways. Some people maybe say black and white here has nothing at all to do with what we're talking about, the ultimate and conventional. But there is a verse, even before I read this, a verse in the commentary in the Book of Serenity here. It's not the main verse, but a verse that's quoted. It has a line, black and white, distinctly clear, determining ultimate and relative. So that's a little precursor to it. Maybe we can see this issue of black and white around being expressed through words and phrases, as all koans. Could even say black words and white words, or clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light, relative phrases, relative words are distinguished in the white light, and all other opposite kinds of words are just merged in the darkness. So they're words that could express the darkness. So this story is that one time a monk asked Master Matsu, apart from the four propositions and beyond the 100 negations, please, here, this translation is, directly point out the meaning of living Buddhism. That's Thomas Cleary's way of simplifying this, but literally it says, please directly point out the meaning of the coming from the West, meaning the meaning of Bodhidharma is coming from the West, which is just a poetic Zen way of saying the meaning of living Buddhism. Sometimes I think Thomas Cleary, you know, misses a little of that poetic spirit there. And this is, you know, apart from all these relative Dharma teachings, right? Like, it's actually referring to Nagarjuna, the four propositions and 100 negations, all these conceptual refutations of light and dark, of extreme views of light and dark. Apart from all that, please point out the Zen meaning of Bodhidharma is coming from the West. Like, don't get into all this technical stuff. Just give it to me straight. The commentary quotes some complicated stuff. Indian stuff gets complicated. This is Asanga. Says, existence is slander by exaggeration. Non-existence is slander by underestimation. That's crazy. And again, we can put this into light and dark. Like, existence is the world of things and the brightness, and non-existence is the principle of darkness. So existence is slander by exaggeration. Non-existence is slander by underestimation. Both existence and non-existence is slander by contradiction. And neither existence nor non-existence is slander by intellectual fabrication.
And neither?
Neither, yeah. Neither this nor that is it's just a nice intellectual idea to try to get around the first three. If you abandon these four propositions of existence, non-existence, both, or neither, the 100 negations are spontaneously wiped out. So that's a little bit a little commentary on this issue of the four negations and or the four propositions and 100 negations. Apart from all that, you know, issue of black and white, and you could say, we could get into Dungshan's five positions of the permutations of black and white and relative and ultimate and existence and non-existence. But apart from all that, please directly point out the meaning of Bodhidharma is coming from the West. And Matsu said, I'm tired today and can't explain for you. Go ask Jurtsang. Well, I'll read through the story first, and we can go back. So the monk followed the instructions and went to ask Jurtsang, a fellow student of Matsu. Jurtsang said, why don't you ask the teacher? And the monk said, the teacher told me to come ask you. And Jurtsang said, well, actually, I have a headache today and can't explain for you. Ask Brother Hai, which is Baijiang. So then the monk went now to Hai, and Hai said, at this point, after all, I don't understand. So then the monk went back to Matsu, the teacher, and related all these discussions to him. And Matsu said, Jitsang's head is white, and Hai's head is black. So we can go back a little bit and look at this. So Zong's head is white. So the white head is the response. I'm tired out today and can't explain for you. Go ask Dijon. And the black head is the response. At this point, or when I come this far, after all, I don't understand. Could you see how, in terms of like our discussion of black and white here, that in the that I'm tired today, I have a headache, is a kind of a white answer, and I don't know, I don't understand, is a kind of a black answer.
How so?
Does anybody see any correlation?
The master is reporting his physical condition at the moment. It's there.
And that's white or black?
That's white.
Okay.
Actually,
black is.
That seemed a little bit black.
Yeah. No. Let me do my thing on this.
Okay.
You asked me. Let me do my thing on this. Okay. So to say that was a loud noise is the white part.
Mm.
What the hell's going on is the black part. What's that about? And this is the point I want to get at. That slamming, at that moment, there was the merging of difference and unity. There was the merging of the ultimate and the specific, if you will. There was the noise, we all heard that, and then there was this other thing that went on, like, whoa, and that's the murky part. And I think what all of this is about, we get too far out in there, you know, and analyzing is what it's all about is being attentive in a way that we're allowed to say, this thing which seems to persist is impermanent, and this thing which seems to be defined is interconnected. And anything that goes on, including our own existence, or that, raises that. And I think the merging is in the actual paying attention, not in the understanding of anything. And so if we get in to try to understand the words, or we get in to say, this is it, we miss it. I think that's the whole point of this thing. And the responses that keep coming through in all these things, in all the koans, the responses are always, well, things like, I think of China, I think of South China in the springtime, you know, or the cypress tree in the garden. Bodhidharma did not come from the West. Bodhidharma always came exactly where he was. There was no West. There was no East. This is the point. And say, what's Bodhidharma? It's not somebody coming from the West. It's Bodhidharma. You know. And I think that's going crazy here. The point of this thing is gets to our practice in simultaneously realizing the ultimate and the conventional. The only path to the realization of the ultimate, I hear it seems, is through the conventional. And the more granular we get that, the more we get it. I think people sitting on mountaintops have to think of things to do. And the Soto Zen people said, let's make rituals. But it's not as myriad as the things that somebody does who's, you know, trying to earn a living. But they have to do something. But it doesn't matter. Can you pay attention in a way that opens up to the, oh my, what is this all about? So I think that's what it's pointing to.
One of my favorite responses to why the Bodhidharma come from the West is sitting long with tired legs. It's actually one of the recorded koans.
That's an example of what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a slap on the floor.
Or like, I have a headache today. And can't explain. But he didn't take that as the answer. He took it as an instruction to go somewhere else.
Well, the answer is, yeah, if your head's that way, my head's this way. You know, that's... So he was clearly looking for something that was not going to be found in terms of, you know, the ultimate or the specific. He was out of his head. You know, and the only way...
Or in his head.
Or in his head, yeah, sure. But not in the rest of them. And so the master is pointing out the here and now reality is I've got a headache. And he still wonders. So he has to go, oh, the master's got a headache. He can't answer me. Thing is, if he'd been fully with the master and his headache, he might have brought him an aspirin. But he wasn't. He was off on his idea. And I think this is telling us we got to get those two things together. And reality as it presents itself is always ultimate and relative. It's always absolute and relative. Always.
And but there's no judgment of better or worse.
There's no better or worse. Unless we say, let's separate them, look at them differently. Unless we say, enlightenment means somehow realizing the ultimate. No. That's not it. According to what I read here, it's being fully present and attentive to things as they arise without any extra.
So in this koan, the punchline of just this one's head is black, this one's head is white, I think is a beautiful punchline because it's just stating like, well, this is kind of a black answer and this is kind of a white answer, but there's no judgment of like, well, I don't know, is actually a better answer than I have a headache, or I have a headache's a better answer than I don't know. But there are these two sides when we're talking about things. But only to talk about things.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think all these sutras and everything else, and you've talked about this before, you know, when we get out there, we find the sutras. And the teacher takes us back home to the simple matter. Any way in which we can cause suffering for ourselves, you know, all our intellectualization, all of our other stuff we do, we're going to find a sutra out there that says, and here's where we are when we're out there. And what I like about Nagarjuna is he says, okay, I'm going to negate everything. I'm going to get you back to the simple matter. We got to ask ourselves, though, do we really want to journey out there? Or do we just want to discover when we're out there that there's a way home? And I think this is one approach to the sutras. When we're out there, you see a sutra that suddenly goes bright on you. Boom, okay, there's a way home here. But it comes down, I think, to what we do here, what we do on the Krishna. That's where it comes home to. And if it's not doing that, I think it's irritating. I won't say another word. You said all my words.
Sure.
I made a doka-san with you so I could say it to you instead of the whole crowd, but I couldn't resist. Anyway, there we go. There we go. Sorry, everybody. Sorry.
That was great.
I don't hear anybody complaining.
That was great. So I think it's interesting that the master Matsu says, "I got a headache." You know, he's in the relative. You know, I mean, the question is, what's the ultimate meaning of Buddhism? And he says, "Well, I can't. You know, I'm going to tell you part of the koan, and then you should go see this person." Mm-hmm. And then he gets again, pretty much the same answer. It's in the relative. Or at least that master is saying, I'm in the relative, I'm going to give you that side of it. But eventually, Matsu knew he would run up against someone who would say, I don't know.
That's nice. No idea. He also had the time between the questions, you know, walking from one teacher to another.
Which one, then, did you say way back? There's one where you exaggerate.
Oh, existence is slander by exaggeration.
Right. Mm. Yeah, and that seems like someone that actually says something, and then the other one is remaining mysterious. What's that under? Under
slander by under
underestimation.
Underestimation.
Underestimation. That's right. What I thought you were thinking of, because that's where I still was when you were telling it.
Mm. So underestimation would have been in the story?
Yeah, like, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it also mm-hmm. reminds me of Katagiri's two books that I've read. What is it? Return to silence and you have to say something.
Ah, there's the two sides.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, right. Maybe even intentionally, I don't know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Whoever titled them. Hmm. And I don't know about all, but maybe most of these Zen koan stories seem to be about, in one version or another, these two sides. And they're often about the white side, actually. Many of them seem to have the side of somebody asking from this wanting the ultimate answer, and they're getting a very relative answer.
But which takes them to the present moment.
Which takes them to the present moment, yeah.
Yeah.
But I like your point about that actually the go ask the next person is kind of like, well, let's, you know, there's more to the story here than just this. Let's see how it plays out down the line. Mm.
I can make a comment of having a memory of them starting to understand a little better. there were two lamas that came and visited Boulder. One was Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche's half-brother, and the other one was another lama who was accompanying him. And we all had like a bowing line walking to greet them. And I bow in front of Trungpa Rinpoche's brother, and I look up, and he didn't move an inch. And I looked in his eyes, there was nothing happening. There was no move to greet me, nothing. And I go to the next lama, and I bow. And he laughs, and he touches my head against his. It's like, so nice to meet you, kind of bud. And I walked away, just going, what the hell is
that? And then the third one said, his head was black, and his head was black.
And then you had to figure out which was which.
The four elements return to their natures just as a child turns to its mother. Do you want to bring up anything about these four elements?
Did you bring up the Dogen?
Shall I?
Yeah.
Yeah, we found Dogen Zenji has, I don't know about in the Shobo Genzo, but there might be some references to the Sandokai, and somewhere I think there is, but in his extensive record, he refers to, I think only twice, to the Sandokai. One talk kind of soon, a few talks after the other, so I have a sense that maybe he was kind of like studying the Sandokai during this time. Since there's kind of like a few lines, and then a few talks later, it's like a few lines down in the Sandokai he comments on again. These are Dogen's kind of informal talks to the assembly, kind of spontaneous talks as opposed to long written treatises. And, you know, he's just, I think, having fun, as he often is. I don't think there's... in this case, I don't know if there's some deep intent behind this, but he's playing with the things we've been talking about. So he says, an ancient Buddha said, each of the four great elements has its own nature and has its own form. So he's quoting part of the Sandokai, that each of the elements returns to its own nature, but I think he maybe adds in this part, also has its own form, unless this is just a different translation of the section, but... The note says he's referring to the Sandokai. Today, for the sake of you monks, I, Ehe, will discuss the nature and form of the four elements. So it's said, and you know, the text here, maybe just briefly, the text is going to just say the functions of these four elements, that fire heats, wind moves, water wets, earth is solid. Maybe Andy could tell us more too about the four elements in Chinese medicine. It's a big topic, right?
It is a big topic.
Five elements, actually, right?
But yeah, there was also metal, which is a little bit like air.
Because sometimes in Buddhist texts too, they had air or space would be a fifth element.
Yeah, space, right? Yeah, mm-hmm. The five Buddha families. Right?
Sounds different than metal, though.
Yeah, there's a relationship when you look at the way metal actually interacts. It's almost working on that a little bit.
So that's as the text says, those are the general qualities of these four elements. But then Dogen's going to, he's just spends all his time sitting in the Zendo like this, so he's kind of like, these are what comes to mind for him. Looks like... I will discuss the nature and form of the four elements. So it is said, the nature of earth is wall-gazing. The nature of water is washing your bowls. The nature of fire is the Tenzo's activity. The nature of wind is a fan in December. Which is another old Zen phrase about the mind of Buddhas are like a fan in winter. Like, it's a useless thing. It's kind of on a sitting on a shelf. It doesn't do anything. You don't need a fan in winter. Except this Zendo. So, in a way, he's talking about the same things. You know, water, the function of water is to wet. Well, here's kind of a Zen specific, getting really specific. It's actually to wash your orioki bowls. And the fire is to heat, but it's what the tenzo uses to cook the meal. As for the forms of the four elements, the form of earth is steady immovability, and this is his phrase, gotsu-gotsu, which Dogen uses to talk about the immovable sitting of zazen, like a mountain. It literally means like a kind of a plateau of a mountain. I think one translation is the mountain still state. So that's the form of earth is this mountain still state. The form of water is eyes. I don't know where he's going with that one. The form of fire is expounding of Dharma by all Buddhas in the three times, which is just referring to this. Dogen is constantly, line by line, like referencing all these other Zen stories. He's just like a total master of doing this. And as I often said, I think probably a lot of these references must have gone right past people he was talking to, because they're just totally woven into everything he's saying. So this is that story of this conversation about the Buddhas are turning the Dharma wheel in the midst of fire and fierce flames, and the response from the other person in the conversation was, actually, the fierce flames of fire are turning the Dharma wheel, and the Buddhas sit there and listen. This is a little reference to that story. The form of fire is expounding of Dharma by all Buddhas in the three times. The form of wind is nostrils, which is a common Zen image for Dogen. Tell me, is what I'm saying the same or different from what the ancient Buddha Shirto said? Do you want to clearly understand? After a pause, Dogen said, that's just like Yun Men, right? He answers himself. A white heron perches in a snowy nest. In sameness, there is difference. Or in equality, there's difference. A crow alights on a black horse. Within difference, there is sameness. So, after this four elements little section of the Sandokai, he gets into the main issue of Sandokai with the black and white and sameness and difference, and just a kind of poetic response. I don't think there's anything different going on between a white heron perching in a snowy nest and a black crow alighting on a black horse. But just for the sake of a poetic verse, a white heron perches in a snowy nest. In sameness, there is difference. A crow alights on a black horse. With indifference, there is sameness. And it's kind of like, you know, there's a lot going on here, because his question was, tell me, is what I'm saying about fans in winter and all this stuff the same or different from what Shirto said? So it's like, you know, we have sameness and difference in Dogen and Shirto. So is what we're doing here in Sesshin the same as what Dogen and Shirto were doing, or different?
Both.
Both is slander by...
Is it exaggerating or what?
Both. What did he say? Both. Existence and non-existence is slandered by contradiction. But neither, well, It's neither the same nor different from what those old guys were doing. But that's slander by intellectual fabrication. Oh, well. And the four elements returning to their natures, just as a child turns to its mother, or a child takes to its mother, a child attains or touches its mother. That's an interesting image, too. The elements returning to their natures, and is the nature of water wetness, or as Dogen says, the nature of water is washing your bowls, or is originally the nature of water just darkness? True nature is emptiness, is principle. Or is it like a child and its mother are like phenomena and principle? Phenomena returns to principle, but light returns to the darkness. Yeah. Amor flees the candlelight and returns to unknown. Eye and sights, ear and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and taste. So this is just, we've already talked about the objects and the senses interacting and at the same time not interacting. Thus with each and every thing, depending on these roots, the leaves spread forth. I wouldn't say these, maybe other translations. It's kind of, I think it's referring to roots could be, in a Buddhist terminology, the character they're using could be like, you know, so like the senses. But but also, we could just see it as the darkness. The depending on the source, depending on the root, depending on the principle root, the leaves of light spread forth, just like the branching streams of differentiation flow in the darkness.
This translation has, so it is with everything everywhere, the root puts forth each separate shoot.
Yeah.
It's a little different.
Yeah, the root, I think, is better than these roots. I think that's maybe the key thing. Is like if you make it plural, then it's not talking about the source anymore, because there's only one root source. The leaves spread from the root. The whole process must return to the source.
We should return to it. I think we should return to
the source.
I keep trying to tell you something.
Is it getting late? Well, that's, we made it through.
The dark myth followed.
We made it through till tomorrow.
Till tomorrow.